This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Ivy Tech Community College statewide has created the Center for Cybersecurity to meet the demands for high-quality cybersecurity education and training, and that especially is true here for the Lake County campus of Ivy Tech Community College. Let's find out more about the program and talk with one of the recent graduates. We have with us Matthew Cloud. He is the program chair of the Ivy Tech Community College IT program, and in particular about the cybersecurity leg of the courses. And also with us, we have a recent graduate from the cybersecurity program at Ivy Tech Community College, Daniel Lopez. Matthew and Daniel, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate you having us here.
And you too, Daniel. Thank you for being with us. Let's start first, Matt. If you will, bring us up to date with some statistics. How important, we probably assume as much, but how important is it really to not only the state of Indiana, but for the entire nation, to be sure that there are enough cybersecurity people out there filling those jobs?
Sure. I'll try to give it in a really quick perspective. My role is actually, there's 11 different programs that I oversee. Mm-hmm. Part of that is we've joined criminal justice in with what we're doing at our campus with cybersecurity because there's such a demand and need for from the law enforcement. They've been asking for help for about 5 years locally in Northwest Indiana. And when you look at the statistics for job openings in Indiana, there's about 4,500 jobs in cybersecurity that are new. It's about doubled in Indiana. But nationwide, the number of jobs that are open has doubled in the past year from a little over 300,000 to 521,000 that are open jobs. And at the same time, we've employed, it went from about 500,000 employed to over 940,000 employed in this past year. But we're not able to keep up with that rising demand and need. And being here in Indiana, you can live with our wonderful cost of living and great way of life and work and do cybersecurity anywhere in the nation.
That's true, because it's all remote now, it seems, or at least it's certainly available through your computer, sir. Yes, it's very true.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about the program itself, how it's laid out, and the kind of foundation that it actually helps build for students who become graduates of the program and go out there and take these computer security jobs.
Sure. So we have a number of IT programs, and often students don't know what they want to do. I have a National Science Foundation grant to help us research how people make those choices.
Yeah.
But we found most of our students really don't have an idea. They hear about computers and they want to go into something that's in that and they can, make good money at it, which is true, but you need to have a good idea as to what you're doing. However, most students, when they come into cybersecurity, have a pretty good idea that's what they want to do. They may be interested in some other things, but about 30% of our students come in there. The nice thing is the first semester is the same. So we've laid out the courses so that people can come in, get their feet wet. You don't have to worry about the math. We can help you get through that part of it. It's not math intensive in particular for cybersecurity and many of our other programs. So there's myths out there about that.
Yes.
Computer science as itself is calculus-based, but there's ways to transition into that. And 90% of what you would do in the computer world has nothing to do with calculus. So cybersecurity is a great example of it. If you know it, it's great. So we've got this program laid out so that you can move through and advance and gain a career while you're getting your degree and do well after that. And I think Daniel's a great example of that.
Yes. All right. Well, let's bring Daniel into the conversation. Now, Daniel Lopez, as I said, has just been a recent associate degree in cybersecurity graduate from Ivy Tech Community College. Tell us, Daniel, who you're working for and what you're able to do with your training that you received, education that you received from Ivy Tech.
When I started at Ivy Tech, actually, I started originally August of 2004.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to give you a little base on it real quick. I attended as a web developer originally. I went back actually as an adult learner in 2018, August of 2018, and I switched programs into the cybersecurity program, and that's where I met Mr. Cloud. And he helped guide me through this program along with all of the professors I had at Ivy Tech, which were all great. So with the training I had in cybersecurity through the school, it helped me for my current position. I'm actually not working in cybersecurity right now. Currently, I work for Salesforce. And that actually was also as well due to Ivy Tech and their joint program for the Pathfinder program that Salesforce offers.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me. But with the cybersecurity program, what has helped me is basically the core classes that I had to take for the program, and organization, database management, you know, programming. All of this goes into my job because of the structure of Salesforce. There's so many different avenues within the company that all require some sort of training, whether it be from cybersecurity itself or some of the core classes that you took in order to achieve that degree.
Now, Daniel, I understand that you're a veteran. You were in the U.S. Navy. Did you have an opportunity to be exposed to anything that led up to you wanting to get involved in certainly in cybersecurity, but going back to school?
So when I was in the Navy, and this will date me, but when I was in the Navy, actually, computers were they were very young, we'll say.
Uh-huh.
At that time, a computer probably had a four gig hard drive. So compared to today, it was very different. But my time in the Navy did give me access to computers. It did train me in, you know, very basic like Microsoft Excel and PowerPoint and Word. And it generally sparked that passion for the technology side.
I understand, Matthew, that a lot of the people that are involved in the cybersecurity program, in particular, and the other programs, I'm sure, too, with Ivy Tech Community College, are transitioning military, people who have maybe picked up some interest in certain projects or certain educations while they've been in the military, but they've decided to expand on that after they got out, and I imagine this is probably just one of them.
Yeah. Yes, that is correct. In fact, I have a couple students that are currently stationed in Afghanistan. Have to pay for their own internet access out there, which I'm trying to work with legislators to change that. In fact, met with a Congresswoman Lorsky's team on that and some other factors yesterday, and we'll be meeting with Congressman Mervin and some others, including our U.S. senators from the state, here soon, on some of the issues to help students transition more effectively. One of the things that we have that we were able to get as part of a pilot program from the National Security Agency, and that allows us to target helping veterans first. Veterans, then right after that is law enforcement, fire, EMT, those first responders,
right,
and then minority-based groups. So if they fall into minority-based groups, we're trying to help those that need the help and should have been helped a long time ago, and for whatever reason have never really been focused on. So we're focusing as part of a nationwide effort. In partnership, Purdue Northwest is the main awardee. Ivy Tech is the workhorse, if you will, putting them through. And we're all working together as well with the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, and the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And a program that allows people to come in for these mid-level skills. So it's not our first semester, kind of skip to that second, third semester. There's a lot of students that can come in at that level that don't necessarily need everything else at the beginning. How do we focus on those mid-level skills that are so much needed in cybersecurity right now? We're the SolarWinds attack is something that's been pretty popular lately. That hit the Department of Homeland Security. It hit some of our major institutions, and we need to find a way to fight back against that. And the best people who can do that are veterans and law enforcement. And how can we do that in a way that's productive against these things that we see in the news media often about different groups fighting with each other? Well, we're going to have, you know, minority groups working with law enforcement and veterans to make sure this is working well, and that we can have those open discussions on things like not just basic cybersecurity, but even advanced topics in artificial intelligence.
Are you finding that all of the media attention, not only about the overseas hacking into U.S. Computer systems, federal as well as state and local, but some of the other problems we're running into lately, just even as recently as people concerned about all these Zoom attacks, you know, by going on Zoom, because we all have to use Zoom for our meetings, but all of a sudden somebody can jump in and disrupt the meeting, and it's not anybody that's with the group. So there are all kinds of problems even related with our computer systems that certainly probably bring up the cybersecurity point very closely.
It does. In fact, we've had discussions both at our college, and I work with many colleges across the U.S. Up until recently, the discussion has been, should we have a general IT course as a basic digital literacy course as part of the general education curriculum for all students to take? And then you have the U.S. Naval Academy. They require students to take a cybersecurity course in their first year as well as their third year. Where we've been hitting on most recently is people need to make sure, if they're going into college, and not just college, anywhere, is they need to have that basic cybersecurity hygiene so that you're not you wouldn't leave your doors open, wide open, except maybe it's a beautiful day and you need to air out the house, right? Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't normally leave everything open in your house all night long. And that's what people have been doing because they're just not aware. Because you can't even see the people coming in until it's too late, right? So we're working with other groups. There's the Gary Community Partnership, which is set up by a gentleman who does cybersecurity for Walgreens as a nonprofit. And that was the idea, was to start on that about 2 years ago. But he started working with the community to actually rebuild the parks and those kind of things first, rebuilding esprit de corps, if you will, to want to fight back against these kind of things. And then hopefully we'll be able to soon start introducing more of these digital literacy skills and actually have, like, there's an assessment for math and English. Another side part of this NSA grant is developing an assessment for IT that's not just saying, hey, it's not saying you're cut out of this. You can't do it because you don't have the skills. It assesses where you're at, and then you can get the skills for free. It actually builds on a Department of Labor TAC grant and the work done out of the University of Wisconsin that provides all this information for free so you can learn those basic digital literacy skills if you're not ready. And then you can be successful in college or wherever else you need to go to get a good degree or a good job these days.
Now, Daniel, if you will, tell us if this opportunity to learn more about cybersecurity by getting your associate's degree, even though, as you mentioned earlier, that you're not working directly in it right now with Salesforce, is it going to possibly open up some opportunities within the company sometime that you'll be able to use more of your education?
So, yes, I believe so. What I've noticed at Salesforce is a lot of the training is now going towards cybersecurity, just to make, you know, general employees aware, but also to ramp up the security because it's needed at this time. And so I do look to the future for that, to moving over and actually using my degree at Salesforce.
We've actually been in discussions with Salesforce. As to moving, Salesforce is focused primarily on helping people make sense of their data, that customer relationship management and those areas of the business. But they have a partnership. The part that Daniel was in was actually a partnership with Salesforce and Deloitte. Deloitte provides the majority of the states with their cyber.
That's Matthew Cloud, who is the program chair of a number of programs at Ivy Tech Community College, including IT and, in this case, the cybersecurity area, and Daniel Lopez, who is a recent associate degree in cybersecurity recipient, and he's now working in the Salesforce. And gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us to talk about the Ivy Tech Community College cybersecurity and IT program.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Jordan Stanfill is the Executive Director of Housing Opportunities, which is based in Valparaiso, and the organization has put in a few more beds to help the homeless people in the community have some relief from the cold, and apparently just in time. And Jordan's with us to talk about that and the other projects and Housing Opportunities has available. Jordan, thanks for joining us in the program today. For people that are not familiar with the organization, what you do and how you're helping, at least initially, to those people who don't have a nice warm place or a dry place to stay.
Sure. Housing Opportunities is a community-based nonprofit that helps to resolve and prevent homelessness right here in Porter and LaPorte County. We mainly do that through providing emergency housing for people who are homeless, and then we provide some long-term supportive and affordable rental housing to help people coming out of homelessness to have long-term housing solutions. And what we're always trying to do is adjust to what we're seeing in the community. Due to COVID and a lot of the reasons, there was a rotating churches that were providing overnight stay for single men in the community for a long time now. And they've had to stop doing that due to COVID. So we saw a little bit of a gap in service need. And with the cold weather coming up, we wanted to, jump on board and add some additional beds and support to people who might be staying outside right now. Mm-hmm. And we just opened up, I think, first week of February. And as you mentioned, right in time before all this terrible cold and snow came in. And so we're adding 10 beds to people who are sleeping outside in their cars, in tents, things like that, to come in every single night until the weather breaks, to be out of the cold, get a meal, and have some support as they need it.
How many people usually come into the shelter, when, aside from the bad weather that we're experiencing right now, how many people come into the shelter on a given night to be able to take advantage of the beds that are there?
Yeah, so our normal shelter is full every day, and we house between 70 to 80 people every single night, and that's single men, single women, and families. And then with our additional kind of 10 beds for the winter folks, we're having kind of three or four nights in the first couple of weeks. And now with this weather, I think we're up to five and six the past few nights. Mm-hmm. So not at capacity yet, but getting closer. And that's typical when people, you know, word of mouth happens, and people who are, sleeping outside or talking to their friends and people they know who are in the same situation, telling them to come see us and get out of the cold.
I understand that you got some assistance from the state government to help provide the additional beds. Tell us first which organization is helping out, and how did you be able to have an opportunity to apply for the assistance?
Yeah, we work really closely with Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, which is kind of our state housing authority. And they do, we work with them every year for shelter services and other housing opportunities. But they've done a lot of COVID relief stuff through the federal government. So they have really been putting an onus on getting people out of the streets and out of the cold to help reduce the spread of COVID. So we actually operate a COVID isolation shelter in Porter County for people who are in shelters or homeless that have COVID-19. We've been doing that for almost a year now. And so this opportunity came up to help support additional bed and capacity needs in our region. And so we were able to get some funds to help cover staffing costs, setting up kind of a COVID-safe shelter space, and doing all those things that we need to keep people safe and get them out of the cold.
I know you mentioned that the churches in the Valparaiso community have helped out. Can you tell us how that arrangement was? And I guess it's only because of the pandemic that it kind of messed up the opportunity for churches to participate in helping take care of the homeless to stay overnight.
Yeah, so for a long time, 14 different churches in Porter County, mostly in Valparaiso, were housing men every single night. So it was a different church every night. And, most of the volunteers and people doing that were, seniors or people who are kind of at high risk due to COVID. And so due to that and a bunch of other reasons, with using space and having a lot of people in a kind of small space, they couldn't keep doing that, with COVID coming on. But they're still really supporting us. We have volunteers who are able to still help us out with staffing. They come three nights a week. So Valpar Nazarene, First United Methodist, and Christ Lutheran Church in Valparaiso have really stepped up to provide that additional support and have people to help us staff our shelter and stay connected to those folks who need help.
When the opportunity came up to be able to add the beds as you have, so this way you've kind of increased the capacity, and that, of course, was a good time because the churches couldn't participate as much, if at all, I suppose. What kind of help have you gotten from the city of Valparaiso? Are they part of the opportunity to be able to help the homeless have some place to stay?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the city's been great, working with the fire department and the city administrator and the city of Valparaiso to help us get up and running, because when you're using kind of a commercial space or it's in the basement of our office to do this sort of thing, there's a lot of regulations to come into place. So the city was great about kind of streamlining that process for us, getting us a quick inspection so we could turn around and open the shelter and all those sort of things that are needed, and then helping us promote the need, helping us find staff, and then also making sure people know about us. The city staff, including police and fire, they encounter a lot of people who might need this service. So, they saw it as a big need for the community right now to have that kind of buffer and need, especially in the middle of the night when, police might encounter someone who's sleeping in their car or in a dangerous situation. So the city of Valparaiso has been great to support this effort and help us get up and running.
I understand that recent studies and some that have been done over a long period of time have looked into how the makeup of the homeless population in Porter and in LaPorte counties, and I understand that single men seem to account for nearly all of it, 80% of the homeless population. How did the opportunity that the Housing Opportunities was able to take advantage of to add to the beds come about? Who was the most, I guess, a citizen or an activist and all who told people about the fact that, that they need more help?
Yeah, I think it is a lot of people coming together. You know, I think we work with a lot of different organizations. We have a what's called a coordinated entry priority list. So anyone who's homeless and works with the homeless population shares kind of one list of people in our community that are in that situation. And so we have a lot of data available to us on a daily basis that's updated in real time of you know, families, singles, people with disabilities that are homeless and in need of shelter and other housing supports. So it's really just looking at that data and talking to our partners in other shelters, you know, the city, and other folks who work closely with that population to really narrow down that focus. It's kind of been a growing trend the last couple of years in terms of a single men accounting for the highest population. There's a lot of reasons for that. We have a lot more supports and shelter spaces for families and women in our region than we do single men. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why we've been adding to our additional beds in our traditional shelter for men over the past 18 months. So we've actually added 24 beds for single men since COVID kind of came on in last March. And that was in direct reaction to what we were seeing from data at the local level.
I understand that, at least in the opinion of one formerly, maybe a homeless person, who complained about how the Poor County Sheriff's Department was handling the issue of the homeless in the community, that it was a case of being told, well, here's a tent and go pitch it someplace and stay in there to be able to find someplace to live. And I'm sure that was probably one of the opportunities that gave you folks with Housing Opportunities a chance to add more.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's always kind of heartbreaking when someone comes to us and with our shelter being full every single day that we don't always have a solution for someone who's in that homeless situation. So we try to make people as comfortable as we can in the meantime while still staying connected to them and helping them to, you know, engage in our services. Maybe they avoid going to shelter altogether, connecting them to, you know, other resources, whether it's, you know, halfway houses, other shelters in the community or other housing supports. And then making sure if they still need that service, you know, when we have an open bed, they can come into that at that time.
We talked earlier in the conversation here about having some place for the homeless to stay in the Valparaiso area during the day, and then, of course, the added beds to be able for them to stay overnight, and particularly helpful when it's gotten cold. Will you tell us a little bit about the opportunities that are provided for people to come in that can do so during the daytime at the Daytime Resource Center?
Yeah, sure. So we operate a resource center. Traditionally, it's open Monday through Friday from 8 to 4. But we've had to cut back on some hours due to COVID. So right now we're open Monday through Friday, 10 to 2. And then we, you know, people can come in anytime during that time. We have a shower, laundry facility for them to use. They can get access to some food, computer access, talk with one of our case management staff to, again, help find housing resources or other service needs they might have. And then just a place to relax and get out of the cold and the elements and not have to worry about kind of what their next step is. So, you know, we're hoping to expand those hours again when we can bring up staffing levels. But right now it's a great opportunity for people to have, especially with this crazy weather going on. Mm-hmm.
Now, if anybody listening is interested in helping somebody out and they know of some homeless that need some help, especially during the winter months here, how can they contact you folks at the Housing Opportunities and to get them to the winter shelter?
Yeah, the easiest way is to call our main office at 219-548-2800, and they'll be connected to a staff member to get some assistance. And then when in doubt, you know, if they need a shelter at night, they just need to show up at our facility between 7 and 8 p.m. Nightly, and then you just go down to it's the only blue door in the building that has a lot of doors, but it's to our resource center entrance, and there's people there to help them out, get them situated and out of the snow.
Jordan Stanville is the Executive Director of Housing Opportunities in Valparaiso, and we've been talking about the opportunities for the organization to help people who are homeless in the Valparaiso area to be able to find a nice, warm, dry place to stay during the winter months. And Jordan, thank you very much for helping us tell other people, and we hope that you get more support in the days and the weeks and months ahead.
Thanks so much.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Data from the Indiana State Department of Health reveal a lower proportion of Black Hoosiers are choosing to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Experts say that hesitancy is valid. and it's a symptom of systemic racism. Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Brock Turner looked into it.
Data show Black Americans are more likely to be exposed to COVID-19 in their workplaces. Another study from the University of Minnesota found that Black, Hispanic, and other racial minority groups are more likely to be hospitalized after contracting the virus. While Black and African American Hoosiers make up nearly 10% of Indiana's population, the demographic accounts for only 4% of total vaccines administered. Statistics like these don't surprise Tara Morris, who heads the Minority Health Coalition of Elkhart County, but they do create a sense of urgency.
We are so far behind in addressing what's in front of us when we look at these health disparities. So we have a huge pandemic out here right now that has actually drawn attention to what has not happened in over the past 20 some odd years. So it's right here in our face. So what are we going to do?
Tony Gillespie, the Vice President of Public Policy and Engagement at Indiana's Minority Health Coalition, agrees.
You can't address 100 years of mistrust of public health and healthcare, period. You can't address that in a webinar.
For Gillespie, much of the distrust stems from historical events. He says the decades-long unethical medical research in Tuskegee, Alabama, drove a wedge in the community that's been difficult to repair. Research confirms this. Other systemic barriers make it more difficult for Black and other minority populations to trust public health officials and health systems. But stories that foster distrust are both recent and local. Late last year, a Black Indianapolis physician, Dr. Susan Moore, published a series of posts and a video of herself lying in a bed at IU Health's North Hospital, describing how she was treated by a white doctor. Moore said she was not receiving the care that a white person would. Gillespie says Dr. Moore's experience reinforces distrust in the community.
Healthcare is a big decision, and a vaccine that didn't exist before a few months ago is the biggest thing that's going to happen in our lifetime.
Dr. Clyde Posley of Antioch Missionary Baptist Church in Indianapolis is well aware of the struggle, but he's also aware of the seriousness of this virus.
My 95-year-old father, I preached his funeral six weeks ago. He was walking and healthy and joking on Thanksgiving. By the Saturday following that Thanksgiving, he was dead, and he died alone. None of his four children could, remaining children, well, none of us could go see him. I'm his pastor. I couldn't see him in the hospital. The next time I saw my father was in a pine box.
That's why, after reading up on clinical trials and conducting his own research, Posley began urging his congregation and those in the community to receive their vaccines.
Something has to be done. And so we cannot simply sit back and allow ourselves to be picked off while we complain and are upset about some real things. We have to deal with solutions.
He's since received both doses without complications, but admits there was trepidation when heading to his first appointment. Morris also received her first dose a few weeks ago. She, too, was hesitant, but wasn't going to let it stop her. All agree vaccine access, dispelling misinformation, and quelling anxiety are important steps, but few things can replace individual conversations with friends, neighbors, and family members who have already received the vaccine.
I don't have that anxiety. It's behind me right now. I know I have that second dose coming up, but it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. I don't have that. That's behind me. I'm more protected. I can be here for my kids, my grandkids.
Her hardest sell might be her 85-year-old father, but Morris isn't going to stop trying.
He is a work in progress, okay?
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brock Turner.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Back with you tomorrow.